So we want to identify the lies that keep the destructive patterns going. And in your handouts, you've gotten a whole list of common beliefs or lies that the destructive person believes. And I'm not going to go over them all because you're going to read them yourself, but, you know, money is my money, or I'm entitled to sex no matter how I treat her, or if she respects me, she won't disagree or challenge my decisions, or I'm the head of the house, therefore she should do what I say. You know, all these lies that, well, you know, if she hurts me, she deserves to be hurt. If I don't hit her, it's not abuse. These are all internal lies that the destructive person believes. And if you don't get at the root of those and lay an axe to them and help them learn to think differently, then it doesn't matter if their behaviors change on the outside. They'll just be more sneaky and covert on the inside. How many of you have encountered somebody who was very aggressive abuser, got arrested, and stopped doing aggressive abuse and started doing covert abuse? Right? Because in the inside, there's nothing any different. The lies are still the same. And so they're just sneakier now about it so they don't get caught and arrested. So if we're going to truly help this man or woman and truly do treatment, we've got to address the sanity stage and understand these lies. These are common lies that women or victims believe who allow themselves to be continued to be mistreated. Keep having to switch two different PowerPoints. So it must be something I'm doing. It's my fault. If only I would try harder, he'd get better. God wants me to stay no matter what. If I leave, God will punish me. It's better for the children. You know, we've talked about these throughout our time together. This is normal. I don't know any different. And so those are the lies that we have to address with the client. But I want to also help you see that you also believe some lies. And we've addressed some of these already. Like God hates divorce more than anything else, therefore stay together at all costs. Or suffering is a virtue, therefore if you're suffering in your marriage, suffer well, and you'll be example of Jesus to your husband and to your children. Or we have no rights, therefore to speak up and set boundaries on your spouse is unbiblical. Or you're both sinners, you're the worst sinner you know, so therefore it's unacceptable for you to speak about someone else's sin or implement consequences or boundaries in that behavior. Like that blog I talked about. Forgiveness means automatic trust and reconciliation, and you can't work on your marriage if you aren't living together. So in therapy, as counselors or pastors, we may have to recognize that we have some of these false beliefs too that shape and influence the way that we do treatment. Just like if this man, whoever lawyer was, if he started counseling a woman who came to him in an abusive situation, the counselor, you know what? Emotional abuse isn't really emotional abuse because you're the worst sinner I know, and so you deserve to be treated. I mean, that's a treatment plan based on a belief he has that's not correct, right? And so we all shape our treatment plan, not only on what we think the problem is, but how our belief system shapes our solution to the problem, right? And so it's very important that you also, as a therapist, identify, and a counselor, and whoever you're working with, a pastor, that you identify some of your own faulty belief systems in this stage, okay? For her, it's really helpful for us to help her see clearly what's going wrong. She is in an abusive relationship. It's not just a troubled marriage, it's a destructive marriage. And to put that into words for her, help her develop core strength. Now, I'm not going to take the time. I thought maybe I'd have some time to unpack that for you, but I'm not going to have the time. But it is in your notes, so just read through that note section. I'm just going to breeze through the handouts here a little bit. And then clarify her role. So let me just go through this a little bit. So core is four steps, and this is what I do to help a woman get stronger. First, I help her to commit herself to the truth, both internally and externally. No more pretending for her. She's going to face what's going on, because we can only solve something if we face it, and including our fears, but we have to start facing what's going on. She's going to be open to growth from the Holy Spirit, from me, from wise others, who are going to help her learn what God says are her options in this situation. She's going to be responsible for herself. That learns to be a good steward, and I have a whole section on stewardship verses that justify boundaries and consequences, but she's going to learn to be a steward of her, and she's going to learn to be respectful to her husband without dishonoring herself. And then she's going to be empathic and compassionate without enabling destructive behaviors to continue. Let me just emphasize a couple of these points without going into that whole handout part of it. Obviously, we want someone to believe the truth and to live in truth and walk in truth, and helping someone do that. The responsible and respectful, it's really important for a woman to take responsibility for herself. So often, they want you to take responsibility for them because they've been dependent or they've been controlled, and it's really important for you not to take responsibility for them, you to teach them to take responsibility for themselves, and not just responsibility for their sins, but responsibility for their life. They need to learn to become owners of their life, not just victims or passive accommodators. And I'm not just talking about, some of women are victims. I'm not saying they're not victims, but you can either think like a victim when you're a victim, or you think like an owner when you're a victim. So when you think like a victim as a victim, whether you're raped or robbed or in an abusive marriage, a victim says, I'm helpless, there's nothing I can do, I'm overwhelmed, this stinks, how can I need help. That's what a victim thinks like, all right? And sometimes they'll come to you thinking like a victim. When they're done with therapy, you want them to think like an owner. Oh my gosh, this happened to me. What do I need to do? Where are my resources? How do I secure safety? What are my next steps? How can I learn from this? What can I grow from this? What do I need to do next? Do you hear the difference? There's an empowering in thinking like an owner and not like a victim. There's a helpless, overwhelmed, I can't do it, when someone typically thinks like a victim. So in this responsible for myself stage, you're really going to empower them to learn to think differently, not just remove the lies, but to actually process life differently through a different set of grids. And so in your handout, I have more examples of how to do that. And then empathic and compassionate, here's where I disagree some with abuse literature, secular abuse literature, is these last two steps. Because a lot of secular abuse literature actually keep women thinking like victims. Like, you're helpless, you're powerless, but you've been victimized, it's not your fault, and there's truth to it's not your fault. But when you dance repeatedly in a destructive dance, you've got to own your part. And if you don't take responsibility for your part, you're never going to know how to get out of the dance, because then you're just dependent on the other person to change the dance, and that keeps you victimized, right? So I don't think abuse literature deals with that really well. And then the other piece is they often say that at the higher the empathy as a woman, the more attractive you are to a narcissist, right? Because you're high empaths. And so when you are very caring and compassionate and forgiving and loving, narcissistic people like those kind of people because you give them what they want. That's supply. And so the answer, though, isn't to turn a woman away from being an empath, right? You want to help her still stay who she is, because that's a beautiful thing about who she is. You know, she's caring and compassionate. You don't want to turn it into hard and mean and cold. And, you know, that's not God's way. He calls us to love. So we want to help her keep her compassion and her empathy without enabling. You see, what happens to women in this situation is they stay soft and enabling, or they get hard and enable. What we want to teach them is stay soft. I'm not happy that you have to go to jail. I'm so sorry you made the decision that I had to call the police. Right? So she can be soft about it, but she's still going to be firm that these are the consequences. Right? So she can be empathic. That stinks that you might lose your job. I totally feel, but you've been warned. You've been told this. So she can be compassionate about all of that and still be firm. And that's really hard for a woman to learn to do, even with her own children. Right? With her children, she's so empathic that she's saying, okay, I'll do your homework for you, right? Or she's like, tell yourself, I'm tired of it already. But she could say, you know, I know math is really hard. These new math facts are really tough, but you got to learn how to do them. Firm, compassionate. And so really helping a woman keep her godliness about her and her loveliness about her without enabling someone to continue to hurt her is really, really important. Okay, so these are the slides that talk about that. So I'm going to move through these really quick, because we're not going to have time to do that. All right. This is worth talking about. How many of you know of the Cartman Triangle? All right, so let me just talk about this really quickly, because this is really helpful for women. So oftentimes women are in this Cartman Triangle is an old tool developed by a psychiatrist in the 80s, 70s, something like that, about destructive, dysfunctional relationships. But I think it's helpful to help a woman see this. So there's three roles on the triangle, and we can play all three roles. As a victim, we can play all three roles. As an abuser, you can play all three roles. The goal isn't to change the role. The goal is to get off the triangle. All right? So let me share my own personal story of how I became aware that I was playing this role. So typically we fall on one of those points as our default mode. So I, and probably all of you, will fall on the rescuer point. That typically helping people tend to fall on the rescuer. So I will overfunction, and I will always do more than anybody else around me. That will be my default mode. I will always overfunction. Growing up in an abusive home, being the oldest child, I had to. So I learned to be the rescuer of our family the best I knew how as a kid, and I still can do that. So I used to rescue Christmas. So when I got married, I never had Christmases that I wanted, so I was going to have the Norman Rockwell Christmas, and I decided that we were going to go and we were going to cut down a tree, and it was 10 feet high, and we were going to take videos so my parents in Chicago could see us decorating the tree and putting it up and baking cookies and cake for Jesus and gingerbread men. And nobody in my family wanted to do that but me. So then I'd become the victim. I can't believe nobody wants to do this. Nobody wants to help me. I can't. I'm so sad. Everybody just, you're ruining my Christmas. I never had Christmas as a child. I just don't get to have Christmas. Or I'd become the persecutor. You guys are so lazy and so inconsiderate. Why can't you just get off your butts? Grandma and Grandpa want to see this picture of us doing this video of a happy family. Okay? So do you see how we can switch roles? And women can do this too. They can overfunction and be this, I'm going to be the godly wife, I'm going to submit, I'm going to do everything, and then they get resentful and tired. Poor me, I can't believe I'm in this mess, the counselor's going to help me, what do I do? I'm just the victim. And then they get mad when you say, yes, you're an abusive relationship. Yeah, my counselor told me you're an abuser, and I don't have to put up with this anymore from you. Right? Right? And the abusers can do this. All right, so they're in the typical persecutor role. But watch what happens when his wife starts to get strong and she sets some boundaries. Pastor, you don't understand what's happening. She won't let me come home. I'm the victim all of a sudden. The persecutor becomes the victim, right? And you're supposed to be the rescuer of the marriage. And so round and round we go. So if you want to study some more about that, go to Google and look up the Cartman Triangle. It's pretty interesting how we all do these things. But your goal with both of them, but especially for her, because he's not as open to learning and she is, really educate her about this and get her off those points and help her to be an adult. What does an adult do? And how does an adult solve Christmas? Right? So when I got off that triangle and I said, hey guys, how do we want to celebrate Christmas this year? What's really important and who's willing to do what? Is it important to have a Christmas tree? Yep. Is it important to have a cut-down tree? Mm-mm. So we just get an artificial tree? Mm-hmm. One Christmas, we never even decorated it. We just stuck it up. Are presents important? Yes. There were certain things that were really important. Is baking a cake for Jesus important? Mm-mm. Christmas breakfast is really important. Christmas lunch, not so. You know? But it was helpful to talk about it as an adult and to negotiate it as a family, and everybody could be okay with it then. Right? Nobody was the victim. Nobody was the rescuer. And nobody was the persecutor. Okay. So, one of the things that is really important for a woman in this place, let me just finish up with this, we really have to teach her how to stop being a man-centered woman or a husband-centered woman or a marriage-centered woman, which is what the church actually teaches women to do, to put all of their hope in marriage and all of their hope in their husband, and he becomes her God, which is a really idolatrous place. And so we really have to help her to become a God-centered woman and not a husband-centered woman. All right, so that's going to be very, very important. We'll talk some more about that tonight. This is also an important diagram. So when you're working with women in destructive marriages, or even with men, so what I help them to do is differentiate themselves. So if you know anything about like cognitive therapy or whatever, we're doing their thoughts and their feelings. And when we talk about their thoughts, we're helping them to understand when you have these angry thoughts or you have these victim thoughts, of course you feel helpless or you feel enraged because your thoughts influence your feelings. You see that arrow between the two. But what I help them to live out of is we call it our big circle. So with a woman in core strength as well as a man, we're helping them say, what's important to you? Who do you want to be? Who do you think God calls you to be? So if I'm working with a woman, she says, I want to be a woman of strength and dignity. That's really important to me. So how would a woman of strength and dignity handle this situation? I know you feel like choking your kid right now. That's your feeling. Or I know you feel like, you know, killing yourself right now, or whatever she's feeling. I know you're thinking that there's nothing you can do right now, but what would a woman of strength and dignity think? How would a woman of strength and dignity handle that? That's who you want to be. And then begin to help her imagine, wow, once I embrace that that's who I want to be, that's my core value, then I can learn to be a woman of strength and dignity even if I feel like I want to kill someone, right? That's what's called loving your enemies, right? You act as if you want how you want to act, not how you feel. Doesn't mean that you ignore how you feel, you pay attention to how you feel, but you don't have to be controlled by how you feel. You just need to be aware of how you feel, and then you decide how you be. Same with a destructive man. So I remember this couple that I told you about where she ended put him in jail, and they're doing better, and they're in this working with couples now. He called me one time on the phone because he had tried to be such a good husband, and he was working so hard, and his wife was had surgery, and he was trying to be the servant leader and all the good stuff that we had talked about, and she wasn't real grateful. She was kind of cranky. So he was like losing it. He was like, I can't believe it. I took the day off work. I took care of the kids. I made them breakfast. I did this. And I did that. And she's just there. And I said, who is it that you want to be right now? That's all I said. Remember the man you told me you want to be. How are you feeling? How are you thinking? Which circle are you going to live out of? Which circle are you going to behave out of right now? You decide. And he said, I'm going to live out of my big circle. That's who I want to be. I want to be a man, a godly husband and father. I'm feeling really mad. I'm feeling really hurt. I'm feeling really disappointed, but I don't have to act out of that place. I can acknowledge it, but guess what I've developed? Self-control. And I can be the man I want to be and the man I'm proud of, not just act out of my emotions all the time. That's such an important counseling principle. All right, especially with this population, but any population. All right. So let me just move on. All right, I'm going to pass by this. All right, so this is important. We need to understand the abuse cycle. So here's the incident at 12 o'clock, whatever the abuse was, like Fred and Marie. Okay? We notice if you watch part two, there is a physical abusive incident after the party. Okay? But I wanted you to get more of a sense of emotional abuse. So there's an incident. Then there's this honeymoon. But you saw this. Every time he would be cruel to her, he would be kind to her. Right? Remember? Like when he turned off the radio and he criticized her on the soup, then he kisses her neck. You know, with Geraldine, he yells at her and then he hugs her. Oh, honey, I love you so much. You know? So there was this cruelty, kindness, and it creates a kind of cognitive dissonance inside of you that you feel a little nuts. Like, he hates me, he loves me, he hates me, he loves me. And there does become some bonding with that. So there's a confusion of which is it. So this honeymoon phase and this calm phase right here, this is where counselors get really confused because they think he's changed. He's not changed. It's just the same cycle, all right? Where you want to see change is from the tension building stage to the incident stage. So when this man called me under this wreck of a tension-building stage, and he said, I'm so mad, I feel like killing her, right? He was aware, I'm building up to an abusive incident, and I need help. I'm calling Leslie, she's reminding me of my big circle, who I want to be, and I can make a choice that's different than I used to make. That's a change. That's a change. When you see someone in the right side of the moon, that's not a change. That's their good side. Everybody has a good side, even abusive people. They have a charming side. They have a lovely side. That's why she married him. But this other darker side between 9 o'clock and noon, you've got to see changes there or there's no changes happening. And you don't see those in the counseling office. That's why a counselor has to report to the wife and find out if there's changes. Because when she says, nothing's changing, you go, but he's such a nice guy. I see he's getting it. You're not putting him in a tension-building stage. He's not in that in your office. So you don't see what choices he's making during that phase. This is an alternative cycle for narcissists. So they abuse, and then when his wife calls him on it, he becomes the victim, kind of like that Cartman triangle. Like, I can't believe you're doing this to me. I can't believe you're calling the police. I can't believe you're going to tell the pastor. What kind of wife are you? Right? And then they become empowered because someone sides with them that she was wrong. And then that's a phase, and then they feel threatened again and abused. So that's a little bit of a different cycle for some people. Is you won't see the honeymoon phase so much as they'll feel like the victim. Again, this promising means nothing. Here's a verse in Proverbs that kind of warns you about that. It says, wait a minute. Losing my PowerPoints here. Here we go. Whoever hates disguises himself with his lips and harbors deceit in his heart. When he speaks graciously, believe him not, for there are seven abominations in his heart. Though his hatred be covered with deception, his wickedness will be exposed to the assembly. So Proverbs is warning you that there are people who've got smooth tongues and deceptive hearts, and we're not to believe them. All right, so let me just breeze through here. I'm going to leave this. All right, so we're going to help her put the marriage in the proper place, becoming a God-centered woman. What's wrong with trying harder? We've already talked about. This is important. Clarify her role. We've talked about this before, but her role as his helpmate, if she's a godly wife, and that's what she wants to be, because a lot of women will resist you when you start telling them to speak up for themselves or set boundaries, because they'll say, that's not godly. And I'll say, well, what is godly? And they'll say, well, a godly wife is to meet my husband's needs. And I'll say, okay, well, let's go with that. What does your husband need the most from you right now? He needs respect. What else? He needs, I don't know, he needs me to have more sex with him. What does he really need? Because there's a difference between felt needs. Where am I? A difference between felt needs and real needs. Okay? So felt needs are, how many of you felt need for chocolate at lunch? Okay? But how many of you said, I'm not going to have that chocolate because my real need is to eat those broccoli florets? Right? You see, our real need is much more less appealing. Right? The chocolate is our felt need. The broccoli is our real need. And so when we look at a husband's real need who's destructive, he might not really need more sex or actually more respect. He might need to be confronted with the truth. He might need serious consequences for his destructive behavior. If she's going to be an agent to be a helpmate to meet his needs, as she prayerfully asks God, what does my husband need the most? He needs to repent. He needs to become a man of God. He needs to come to his senses. Well, then how can I help him do that? That's empowering her. That's empowering her with biblical principles to help her meet her husband's needs. All right? All right, so for him, he's going to have to be able to see his wife differently as a person to love and not an object to use. He's going to have to be taking responsibility for the way he treats her and the way he talks to her, challenging fantasies, lies, and wrong thinking, and developing empathy for his wife in this place. So when they're crying and crying and crying, you need to listen. Why are they crying? And oftentimes they're crying because they're in pain, which you can be very empathetic. Yeah, it's awful to be kicked out of your house. And I know you miss your kids. And it's really hard. It's so embarrassing that everybody knows now that this happened in your family. So you can, I'm not telling you to be hard-hearted about it, but what's he really crying about? He's crying about the pain he's in, which is totally legitimate, but he's not crying for the pain he's caused. There's a difference, right? So our counselor's heart go out and we say to his wife, he's so sorry. He's not sorry. He's crying because he's in pain, for sure, but not because he's repentant. Not because he's sorry for hurting somebody. He's sorry that he's in the mess he's in. All right? And again, we can be empathetic, but don't be enabling. And don't nullify God's law of consequences. All right? There's a powerful law of consequences. And the Bible says fools don't listen to words, right? But sometimes tough consequences get their attention. Not always, but sometimes. And if you're dealing with a fool, or a wicked man, like Henry Cloud says, for some people, jail does them good, right? And that's the only thing that's going to wake them up, if that. All right. How they hated knowledge and chose not to fear the Lord. They rejected my advice and paid no attention when I corrected them, God said. Therefore, there are consequences of that. They eat the bitter fruit of living their own way, choking on their own schemes. Why is it that we somehow tell a woman that implementing consequences is cruel and unusual punishment? It is not. It's biblical principles. And consequences should fit the crime for sure, but it is important not to short-circuit the learning process of what God has in mind. Sorrow isn't necessarily biblical repentance. We've talked about that. So let me just, these are verses that say that words don't mean anything. So here God says, if anyone has this world's good and sees his brother in need, yet closes his heart against him, how does God's love abide in him? Little children, let us not love and talk, but in deed and in truth. So when someone's talking about changing, but they're not yet changing, don't believe their talk. All right? We want to see the fruit of repentance. And you have a list of that in your handout. All right? That's the fruit of repentance. We want to see them willing to make amends rather than expecting amnesty. They're willing to take ownership for the pain they've caused, willing to be accountable for the damage they've caused, and willing to do the necessary work, and are grateful for the chance to do so. I mean, if you left here today and someone backed into your car and smashed it so that you weren't able to drive home, I doubt if you would just say, "Go be well, my brother. I forgive you." Right? I hope they would say, "I'm so sorry. Oh my gosh." And they would be willing to take ownership for the pain they've caused. This is going to inconvenience you. You're not going to have your car. How can I get this fixed? They're willing to be accountable for the damage in terms of paying, insurance, deductible, all of that. And they're grateful that you're not biting their head off for what they've done, right? They're not saying to you, "Now, you're a Christian, you're in this church, you went to that temple, you need to forgive me, sir. You need to let me go. No consequences." That's what a forgiveness does. That's what a Christian does. No consequences. I shouldn't have to pay that. If you have mercy in your heart, you should just let me go. That's what they say. That's what they expect. And sometimes we as counselors, they don't quite say it as obvious as that. But that's what they're saying. And we're going, That's what a Christian does. That's not biblical. It's not biblical. So, five seeds of lasting change. Clarity, they see clearly. Commitment, they're committed to the process. Confession, they own what they do. They have community who are going to hold them accountable. And they understand the law of consequences. So they might be willing, but they're not yet capable. So last December, a year ago, 2015, my good friend Sue challenged me at a New Year's Eve party, and I was not drinking. She challenged me to run a half marathon with her in April. And I had never run a race in my life. I'm 65 years old, almost 65 years old. So I'd never run. I didn't run in high school or college or for exercise. I walk, but I never ran. But I'd always had that on my bucket list. So I said, okay, I was willing. How capable do you think I was? So December 31st, I was willing. But then I had to what? Train and work. Did I feel like it? No. I had to go out and I had to run and run and run and run and run and walk and, you know, throw up everything. It was just awful. But I'm a person of my word, so I was going to do that marathon in April, and I did. Haven't run since. Not going to do it again. Checked it off my list. That was that. And it was an achievement. I put it on Facebook, like, yay, I did the Moore Half Marathon New York City, and I got my medal, and everything I threw away at my house when I moved to Phoenix, I saved that medal. It was just, like, too precious. But this is sort of what we're talking about with change. Okay, they might be really willing, but they can't do it yet. They're not capable. So it doesn't mean we get them back together just because he's got it and he's willing. He's got to learn to be capable, and that means he's got to go into a training regime. And if he's not willing to do that, they don't go back together yet. We sometimes get real excited. Someone's, "Oh, they finally got it. Yay. You finally are repenting. Yay. Okay, now we got to get back together." The last thing you want is a treatment failure. The last thing that you want is abuse to happen again, because they both get discouraged about that. So we want to protect the process. Even if they're willing, they may not be capable. So changes one and two are a change of heart. Here's an evidence of a change of heart. Humble versus proud, willing versus willful, grateful versus entitled, God-centered versus self-centered, love-filled versus fear-filled. We want to see evidences of that. But as my wise friend says this, a persuaded mind and even a well-intentioned heart is a long way from exact and faithful practice. Okay? So, how do we get to the next stage of stability? John the Baptist said it best when he said, "Prove by the way that you live that you've repented of your sin and turned to God." And so our goal in stability is to not repeat old history. All right, so we've already looked at this abusive cycle. And so during this tension building stage and the incident thing, we want to see some real changes. And so what does new history look like? It looks like this, the ability to recognize and own his or her problem. Just like the man who said, "Oh, I see that I was selfish at the beach." He repeated a little bit of old history and that he was selfish, right? But he did see it, which was new history. whereas before he didn't see it. So ability to recognize and own his problem, willing to receive feedback from others, humbly, he's teachable, respect and care for the personhood of the other, safety and sanity, and willingness to work hard over the long term. And that's what creates stability. So let me just take this diagram. So here's this mountain of old history, okay? And patterns don't change overnight. So nobody changes overnight, including even normal people. There was times I didn't want to run. You know, you don't change bad habits overnight. So you've got this old history, and you're going to try to build some new history. There's two essential bridges that must be happening in order for us to be assured that new history is happening. Because someone can be on their good behavior for a while. That's not necessarily new history, all right? Like, I'm not really going to be a runner. I ran for a marathon for 4 months, that's it. So it wasn't really new history. I didn't change my life. I changed some habits for 4 months, and then I went right back to not doing it, right? So that happens oftentimes in abuse patterns, right? And so we don't want that to happen. So what we want to see is there, and I didn't take the time to go through this, but it's in your notes, there's a self-awareness, because it's that blindness. Remember the blindness that keeps people from changing because they're so proud and they won't see it? So once they see it, they have to begin to grow in self-awareness. I'm growing in a self-awareness how selfish I am, how much I use people, how little empathy I have. I'm aware that I've been verbally abusive. I'm aware that I've demanded my own way. I'm aware that I'm being selfish right now. There's an awareness that grows as someone's growing and healing, right? If that's not happening, they're not really changing, right? So that must be happening. The blindness has to start going away, or they can't really make changes. It's just fake plastic fruit on a tree that's still old, right? So we want to see some genuine awareness of themselves. That's why when he said, "I see I was so selfish," that was encouraging because he had more self-awareness. I didn't tell him he was selfish. He told himself he was selfish, right? So we want to see that happening. And then the other thing we want to see happening is that when his wife or someone else gives him feedback, if he's not seeing it, so if she says, "You're scaring me right now. You're talking so loud. Or you're driving too fast right now and it's scaring me. It's reminding me of the road rage things he used to go into." Does he hear that and honor that and change his behavior? If those things don't happen, new history can't happen. All right? So when a couple is separated, so I'll give you an example. A couple was separated, and their biblical counselor said, "You've been separated for 6 months. You had a PFA for physical abuse. You need to come back. 6 months later, it's time to go back." No, she says, "He's not changed." "He's changed. He hasn't hit you for 6 months." She goes, "Well, he can't hit me. He's got a PFA. He's still disrespectful. He doesn't respect my boundaries." "How do you know that you can't work together?" She goes, "Because I don't trust him." "How do you know that?" She says, "It's because, for example, Sunday night he was at the house watching the kids. I asked him to leave. I was tired. I wanted to go to bed. He told me I was being selfish because he wanted to watch a football game. I asked him to please leave, that I wanted to go to sleep. I was tired. He said, you know, 'You're the one who made me leave this house. This is my house, my TV. I have to live in this little one-room house because of you.'" No self-awareness that he was in the position because of what he did. No willingness to honor her wishes and respect her boundaries. No self-correction even. Even if in the middle of his sentence he would have said, "You know what, I sound like my old self. I don't like that man anymore. I don't want to be him. I'm so sorry." Even if in the middle of that tirade he would have caught himself and stopped himself, he would have had new history, right? "Oh, wow, that's amazing. He never did that before. Maybe there's hope." But he didn't. And then when she gave him feedback, "You're not respecting my boundaries, and you're scaring me. Oh, you're so reactive. You're so sensitive. What is wrong with you? Haven't you learned a thing in counseling?" Is the man changing? No. Did he ever hit her again? No. But his behavior is the same. There is no new history, other than he's not physically abusing her because he's not living with her and doesn't have access to her that way. And so we need to ask her, how are things going? When you give him feedback, does he hear you? Not that he jumps through every hoop, but when she's saying old history, it smells like old history right now. It feels like old history. Maybe, like, I'm having this problem with my husband right now because he almost ran out of red light about 6 months ago. He doesn't talk and drive at the same time really well. And so we were, like, engaging, and then he almost went through a red light. So I'm having a little trauma reaction from that. So a couple times I'm going, "Stop!" And he goes, "I saw that red light." You know, I'm like, stop. And he goes, I'm sorry. I know you're a good driver. I don't feel afraid at all to drive with you, but I'm just like having a trauma reaction from the time he almost went through the red light. And he doesn't like me doing it, but he's okay because he understands. So when I'm giving him feedback, he's receiving it, but he's saying, thanks, but I didn't need it. But he's not mad at me for it. You know what I'm saying? That there's a sensitivity to when he almost went through the red light that I'm still having a little reaction to that slip up of his ability to see the light. And so I think it's important that we honor that, and when that doesn't happen and there's no self-awareness or little reception of feedback, it's impossible to build stability in the marriage because there's no confidence happening that new history is happening. Make sense? All right, we have a couple more minutes, so let me just go through trust real quick. Because I think that one of the disservices that we don't know how to do in counseling, even if you don't have a destructive marriage and there's just been an affair, or there's something where trust has been broken down, and they're trying to reconcile, but how do you rebuild trust? How do we rebuild trust in a broken relationship? Because it doesn't happen automatically. You give someone your trust when you first meet them. That's innocent trust. But once innocent trust is lost, you have to now have rebuilt trust. And if that's not happening, the marriage is still fractured. So these are the areas where trust breaks down. Safety, honesty, compassionate care, reliability, financial stability and security, and sexual fidelity and integrity. All right, it's not just trust breaks down sexually. Trust breaks down in lots of different areas. Do you hear me? Do you care for me? Am I important to you? Will you tell me the truth? Do you manage our money well? Am I safe with you? And so we want to rebuild trust. And so let me just give you a couple steps for this. Here's four quadrants that I work on with people. First, authenticity. How many of you have ever met somebody who's got really smooth words, but you don't trust them? Why? Because they seem like a fake, right? We don't trust people who aren't authentic. And so when a wife sees that her husband is charming at church and awful at home, or he's two people, or he acts real nice to somebody and then he says, oh, what a loser, when he comes home, she doesn't know who this man is. She doesn't trust his character. She doesn't trust his authenticity. Who is he? Who is the real him? And so this is the hardest piece of trust to rebuild, because most people who are good fakers aren't authentic, and they won't be authentic. They live out of their false self, and they won't own that. So authenticity, when that trust is broken, is very hard. And so when a woman says to you, I don't know who he is, and he's fooling you, but he doesn't fool me, there is a difficulty in rebuilding that trust, because they're very good chameleons and very good actors and great liars. And I've been fooled by them, and you will be fooled by them. So they have to stop pretending and start being more authentic, and it's really, really tough for them to do that. So trust often doesn't get rebuilt. However, the second place that trust breaks down is reliability. Can I count on you to do what you say you will do? In lots of areas, you tell me you're going to put controls on the computer for your pornography, but you don't. You tell me that you're going to go to counseling and you're going to make an appointment, but you haven't. You tell me that we're going to work on a budget, but you didn't. You tell me that we're going to do a date night, but we haven't. And so I don't trust what you tell me. And then you wonder why we don't have a good relationship, because it's not that I don't believe anything you say, but I can't count on anything you say, because you haven't been reliable in what you say. And that issue needs to be brought up and talked about, because it does damage a relationship. Even if it's not a destructive relationship, it's a hurtful relationship, and it needs to be talked about. The third area of broken trust is incompetence. And this is hard for men, because sometimes men aren't competent in certain areas, and it's hard for them to take responsibility for that. Like, my husband grew up in an apartment in Chicago, and he's much more handy than he was when we first got married, but he wasn't like my dad, who always fixed everything and did everything himself. And my husband just didn't have a dad like that. My husband, if computer, yeah, anything like that, IT, yeah, but you know, the lawnmower, no. The car, no. But my husband had no problem saying, I don't know how to do that. Call somebody. Right? Call somebody. So when you're not competent in something, whether you're not competent in relationships, or you're not competent in spiritual things, or you're not competent in, you know, directions, or you're not competent, whatever, you're not, everybody's not competent in a lot of things. But you take responsibility for it, and you say, you know, I need to learn how to do that better. I need to learn some things. I need to grow. There's no shame in growing. There's a lot of trust building and growing when you say, wow, I don't know how to do this really well, but I want to learn. Or I don't know how to do this really well. You can take responsibility for our finances, because I'm not good, and I'll take responsibility for this, what I'm good at. And we talk about that and how we share partnership. But when I lie about my competency, or I fake my competency and I'm constantly letting you down, that breaks trust. And I don't trust your competency, and then you're mad at me because it looks like I don't respect you. But it's not that I don't respect you. I don't trust that you can do this because you've shown me you can't, and yet you don't own that and take responsibility for that. And then the last area is care. And this is a big one. Can I trust you to care about who I am, what I need, or what I think? And when a woman often says that to her husband who's a narcissist, it always comes back at, well, you don't care about me, because the only one who's supposed to be cared about is me. It's not that she doesn't care about him, but the only person he ever thinks about is me. And so it's not a matter of you don't care about me. It's you don't care about me solely. Like, the tick doesn't care about the dog. Right? The tick doesn't care about the dog. It just wants to use the dog for the blood that it needs. And so when we don't have care, you don't care about me, you don't care about how I feel, you don't care about what I need, you don't care about the person I am, you don't care about who God wants me to be. I mean, I have to tell you, if my husband didn't support this ministry, I can't tell you the number of women who never get to do what God called them to do because their husbands don't want to support them, that don't want to bless them and say, I want you to be everything God wants you to be. They just want them to take care of them. And so when a husband cares about his wife and cares about who she is and who God calls her to be and what she feels, and vice versa, that builds trust. And I think one of the most beautiful verses in Proverbs is in 31, where it says he trusts her, and I would say she trusts him about marriage. He trusts him, or she trusts him, to do him good, not harm, all the days of her life. And that's the beauty of the restoration of the marriage. If you can get to a place where they trust that they're going to do good, not harm. So for her, in this stability stage, new history has to be built as well as new trust. She has to learn to walk in core strength as he does and let go of the resentments and fears. He needs continued accountability for a long, long time. Build new trust, develop compassion, empathy, ability to hear and respond to feedback, confession, amends making. And this is very, very long, hard work for him. And I'm not going to take the time, but here's a great example in Scripture of a man who needed healing. And he went to Elisha. And he went to Elisha. And remember the story? He had leprosy. And what did Elisha say to him? Go. He didn't even open the door. He just said, go wash in the water. And he was outraged. Naaman was what? I'm not going to do that. That dirty river. I'm not going there. I'm not going to dip myself in. So I'll just go home and do it. And he didn't want his treatment plan. And Elisha said, suit yourself. Like, he didn't go running after him. Okay, only dip one time. You're a very important person. I'm so sorry. I should have done it this way. Elisha just said, you know, you don't want to do it God's way. Don't. Too bad. Have leprosy. And we sort of have to have that attitude. That this is the treatment plan. This is what you need to do. If you don't want to do it, okay. But then you're not going to get better. It has to be that black and white. So these are the things that he needs. 7 dips. And with practice and patience, it leads to healing. So security, she brings him good all the days of her life. So I'm just going to let go of this. We've done this already. But let me just close with this. Silence in the face of evil is itself evil. God will not hold us guiltless. Not to speak is to speak. Not to act is to act. And so you're all here for a reason. I think God wants you to speak up in your communities, in your churches, with the members that you can influence to deal with this. So I know we're done, but I'm going to stand here for another 15 or 20 minutes, answer questions. For those of you who need to leave, please go. Do not feel that you will hurt my feelings at all. But I do want to make myself available if possible. I don't know if we have to clear out of the church at 3. Okay, so I do want to make myself, I didn't ask that first. So if anybody has any questions, I'm happy to answer them. And you're...
Let's thank Leslie. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. A couple quick announcements. There are still a few more PowerPoint if you didn't get a copy. If you're planning to come tonight, you don't need, for ladies, they don't need the name tags, but if you're coming tomorrow for the couples sessions, if you could wear those tomorrow. If you're looking for CEUs, you must sign out in order to get a certificate. So at the registration table, you need to go by there and actually sign out, and we'll give you a certificate so that you can get those. Pauline, is the book table going to be open? Yes, we get a thumbs up. Thank you. Have a great afternoon.
All right, anybody have any questions? Yes. Come closer or speak louder. What are the resources? It depends on her resources personally. So certainly a person can go to a shelter, like they talked about here, because those shelters are usually anonymous. Nobody knows where they are except for the people who take them there. So that's a safe place in an emergency, but that's not a long-term solution to her safety plan. So I think that the goal is to, if she's going to move out to a secure place, if there's truly a threat of him like shooting her or something like that, to get a restraining order if she can. But ultimately, she's going to have to be responsible for her own safety, and that means changing her routine, informing people she works with, so if people see him on the premises, that they call the police, that she have an alarm system on her house if possible. And I think that's where other people in the church could help, because most women don't have any money to put all that stuff in place. So if there's people who can say, okay, you're moving into an apartment, the apartment won't let you put a whole alarm system in, but we can put some alarm systems that are, you know, Bluetooth or however they do them nowadays, that will let you know that someone's walking your door, you know that someone's in your apartment when you're at, you know, on your phone, they'll let you know all those kind of things. I think those are ways that we can help a woman protect herself. But I think this is a horrible thing to say, but if someone is bound and determined to kill you, they probably will. They probably will. You know, so I was telling somebody at the break, my husband's carrying a gun now. He never carried a gun until I got threatened, and he carries this gun now. And I said to him, well, I'm not always with you, so if someone wants to kill me, they probably will. But I can't think of a more noble way to die. I mean, I don't want to die that way, but I can't think of a more noble way to die. But I think the woman should do all she can do to be smart and protect herself. But ultimately, our life is in God's hands. And so what I say to a woman, you're going to have to make a decision. You're going to either live in fear or you're going to live in faith. And you're going to live your life and you're going to be as safe and as smart as you can, or you are going to just live in your house with the blinds drawn and you're going to be cowering in fear the rest of your life. And that's no way to live. And so I think that she has to come to a decision of coming to peace with, I'm going to do all I can do, get all the resources I can, develop a good safety plan, and ultimately I have to trust that and move far away if I can, but if you have kids, you can't. And so there's all of those legal things. So that would be what I would kind of go with. Any other questions? Yeah. So if a person is willing, like a man who has some mental illness challenges, you know, Asperger's, other brain, you know, early Alzheimer's onset, you know, dementia kind of issues. I think that's important to live in the truth, right? So to say to someone, what can they do? And can they create a marriage where it's safe and it might still be disappointing? Because he's not as helpful or as thoughtful or as caring as you might like him to be, but can he learn some things to make it safe and not crazy-making? And again, I wouldn't determine what that looks like for a person, but I would say, is that what he can he be capable of that? If he can't, like someone with has a brain disorder or a chemical disorder that they might be violent, schizophrenic, paranoia, schizophrenia, okay? I don't know that anything someone could do would be guaranteeing that he's going to be safe, even if he takes his medicine. He might not take his medicine. So then, do we say to a woman, you have to live with him after he strangled the cat and he might hurt her? Or do we say, it's okay for you to be safe and still be empathetic that I'm sorry that you're willing, but you're not capable? You know, I think those are judgment calls that nobody else can make but her. and her conscience before the Lord as you help her process all that through. I had a man who stabbed his wife recently, and when we did an abuse assessment and the history and the pattern, there was no history of abuse. She said he's a good man. He had been in ministry this whole life, but he had been given wrong medication and had a psychotic episode with the medication. And so he was actually released from prison and all of that because he just was medicated wrong. He wasn't, you know. So I think there's times to really look into all of that and what can someone do and what can. And when he got off the medicine, he was fine. So, but when someone is willing but not capable, and how willing, you know, like how willing, because it's like I was capable of running a half marathon, but I wouldn't have been willing to run a whole marathon, you know. And so I think sometimes the whole treatment plan or the whole thing of what they might have to do, they might be willing to do some of it, but not all of it. And so I think part of it, you have to kind of assess, what are you willing to do? And is that enough? Any other questions? Yeah.
What is your take on no contact? Do you hear that?
She asked, what is my take on no contact? So no contact is a strategy for safety against harm as well as crazy making. And if it's possible to do that, I think it's a quicker way of healing. It's sort of like when you're in this crazy cycle, there is an addictive quality to it that draws you back into it. So we talk about the betrayal bonds or trauma bonds. So I think it's like, you know, getting rid of the sugar or whatever it is that draws you into some substance that's not good can be helpful. But for a lot of women, when you have children, that's not possible. You still have to have communication about visitation, about money, about doctor's appointments, all kinds of things. And so no contact would be an ideal thing. I don't think it's a bad thing. I don't think it's unbiblical to say the consequences of the dysfunction is so serious that right now, for now, I need to be in no contact because for me, it's toxic. So it's not judging you, it's saying for me, I'm not handling that well. I'm not strong enough to handle that well. So for me, I'm not gonna see or talk to you. Well, usually when someone goes no contact, it's because it's the end of the relationship. All right, so it's the end of the relationship, and I don't want you to keep bugging me to get in contact because I'm done. It's not like they're working toward reconciliation. All right, when they're working toward reconciliation, there might be boundaried contact, which I think is helpful because then you're seeing whether he's respecting those boundaries, whether he's able to honor those rules and those requirements, or are his needs always more important than anything else, which again show he's not really changing. Right. Anything else? Yeah.
I noticed that you talked about different types of emotional abuse, and you sort of tangentially touched on adultery. Mm-hmm. And but adultery has a lot of the characteristics
right.
of abuse, such
right.
as deception, you know, money, et cetera. At what point do you consider adultery to be abusive within the relationship?
I think adultery is abusive when it's chronic. Repetitive, when it is lied about. I'm not saying anybody comes and says, hey, I'm going to commit adultery and does it, you know, but when it's repeatedly lied about, like I think if a woman says, are you committing adultery? And her husband is, and he lies about it, that's probably normal. But when he plays the switcheroo as if she's crazy and he kind of gaslights her about it, I think that's emotionally destructive. I think that when he says it's over and it's not, and he's willing to go to counseling and act like it's over, but it really wasn't, it's emotionally abusive. So those are all components too. It's awful even when someone makes a horrible mistake and is caught in that trespass. But I've met people who have done that who have, you know, truly been repentant and didn't do all the other things. But when there's a combination of all that crazy making and deceit and emotional abuse that goes with it and all of that, I think that that is just part of the package. Okay? You have a question?
Joint custody with an emotional crazy making abuser who is now can't do it to his ex-wife so much but is doing it to the children on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Any advice for a woman in a situation like
Yeah, so there's two kinds of things that happen. One is that there's something called parental alienation syndrome, where the abuser, or it could happen in the non-abuser too, but usually it's the abuser who starts vilifying the parent. You know, your mom's crazy, she's, you know, mentally ill, she's ungodly, she kicked me out, lying about her, she had an affair, she's sleeping with, you know, the neighbor. I mean, just outright lies, innuendos about her, so that his intent is to alienate his children so that they're on his side and against her. And that happens quite a bit, especially as the children are older. Oftentimes what happens is the woman has been that over-functioner, and so she's been the rescuer of the family. She's never been a person in her own right, even to her own children. So once she starts waking up and she's saying, hey, I'm more than just the mom. I'm more than just the wife. I'm a person, and I have my own feelings here, and that hurt. Or no, I don't want to babysit your kids 60 hours a week. This lashback of how dare you be so selfish, because she sort of groomed them to think of her as a overfunctioner, that all I'm here for is to meet everybody's needs. So she has to own some of that pattern that she's established all those years that's made it easier for her husband and them to turn on her when she puts her foot down and says, wait a minute, what about me? Because she never did that when they were littler. And so she's taught them to think very selfishly about her. And so then that parental alienation when they're older becomes a little bit more simplified on him, because they can say, well, Mom, why aren't you just sucking it up like you always did? Why aren't you just willing to do it for our family like you always did? Why aren't you willing to do, you know, they overfunction like you always did? What's wrong with you now? You know, and even though she'll try to explain, I'm getting healthier, I'm waking up, that's not good enough because you're wrecking our family, right? And the husband will collude with that mindset. So the only thing that she can do, so that's one type of thing. And then there's another type when the children are even littler, is where the gaslighting and the crazy making, even when a child says, oh, I don't like, oh, yes, you like that. You know, I don't want that. Yes, you do. You know, kind of teaching them to deny their own feelings or distrust their own perceptions of things. He'll do that to them as well. And so there's a different strategy for that. So is there one or the other that you're interested in?
This is a situation where she escaped with her seven children because of sexual abuse, mm-hmm. but the court didn't believe her and gave joint custody. And it's a situation where it's continuing, but there's all the mind games with the children, mm-hmm.
Yeah, so if it's mostly about themselves, I think that the only thing that a healthy parent can do is, if I had a blackboard here, I would so if you have a paper, draw three columns, okay? And remember when we did that circle with the big circle and the thoughts and the feelings? Okay, so this would be along the thoughts and the feelings thing. So there's a situation, there's thoughts, and there's feelings. And all of us have thoughts about whatever situation we're in, right? So children especially have very egocentric or self-centered thoughts about the situation they're in. So for example, if the situation is daddy is mad and they feel scared or sad, they're going to tell themselves daddy's mad at me. They're going to personalize it, because that's how children read it. Even if baby brother dies and nobody corrects their thinking, they're going to think baby brother died because of me. Because children think that way. They just internalize everything or personalize everything. It's my fault because I hated him that he was born, right? And they're going to think, blame. So it's imperative for a parent to kind of go into that middle column of a child's thinking and correct. So we all do this with our kids, like, oh, I didn't get picked for the baseball team because I'm such a lousy player. And you say, no, the reason you didn't get picked for the baseball team isn't because you're such a lousy player, but because there was 50 kids who tried out and they only took 6 kids. You're a good player, but you just weren't one of the 6. So you're going to correct that thinking. Or I failed the test because the teacher was so stupid. No, you failed the test because you didn't study the night before, right? So we're going to correct their thinking. So one of the things a mom does when she listens to the way her kids are talking to themselves about what happened is she will correct that thinking error as best she can. Now, she can't make them think differently, but she can help them perceive it differently. So, for example, when, you know, my kids would do certain things and, you know, I would correct their perceptions. No, she's not saying this because she hates you. She's saying this because she has, you know, mental illness, and that's what they do. You know, when grandma would say certain things, my mother, you know, she has mental illness and she doesn't know how to treat people. You know, so instead of letting my kids personalize that, I would just tell them the truth, right? So I think a mom can do some of that without calling the dad, you know, your dad's a lousy person, a sexual abuser, because then she's going to be accused of parental alienation. What she can say is, you know, the truth is you live at two different households, and you're going to have to learn how to manage both households. And as the bigger they get, the more they're going to have to learn to do that. If something really bothers you, what could you do? Let's brainstorm about it. You know, or if daddy's told you that you're not right, let me think about it. What do you think? I think your feelings are pretty okay in that situation. What do you think? I think it was okay for you to be angry about that. I think most people would be angry. What do you think? So helping them to think for themselves, helping them to validate their own thinking, helping them to revisit that situation, to reframe it so that they're thinking correctly about it, that it's not their fault, or they didn't get it wrong, or they didn't misinterpret, or they did misinterpret and it wasn't that way, so that they're trying to grow up as healthy as they can in a toxic environment. And so she's going to have to make those adjustments as best she can and pray like mad. Yeah.
Several years ago, our church decided to really focus on child safety.
Mm-hmm.
And going through that process, we learned things that would be very helpful to kind of be proactive,
mm-hmm.
like to talk about it.
Right.
So that people who might be abusers would hear us talking about
right.
it and think, hey, we can't.
Right. This isn't an easy target. Right. Mm-hmm. I do think that the whole, you know, I have rarely, my pastor started doing that after he read my book, but I think the whole idea of, you know, I don't think you have to make a whole sermon on abuse, but I do think there's plenty of times when you're talking about passages in Colossians and Ephesians especially, or 1 Peter and submission, all those passages that you talk about, you can sort of weave in some of what I said. This is what headship is, but guys, if this is what you think headship is, that you get your own way and you get to have the final say, how many of you guys have heard that because you're the head, that's what my pastor told me, Leslie, you know what this means now? You're getting married, your husband always has the final say. I'm like, really? You know, but that's what I was taught in my premarital. So you could say something kind of joking, like how many of you have heard you get the final say? Guess what? That's not what God is teaching about headship. You don't get the final say. Guess what? You get to serve first. Who wants to serve first here? You know, you could kind of teach it in a different way, or, you know, let no abusive speech come out of your mouth. You know, what happens when this happens at home? What happens to family members when you get beat up verbally or you get vomited on? You know, how does that feel? And what does that impact your marriage? And you could talk about that a little bit. And as you do, it's going to do two things. It's going to let the person who's the victim of that know, wow, this church isn't going to beat me up if I tell. They're going to help me. And it's also going to help the person who's misusing headship and submission to do one thing, either say, this isn't the church for us, we need to leave. Because those kind of men really are attracted to patriarchal churches that reinforce the doctrine of I get the final say. So you might lose them in some way, but then you don't have to deal with them. Somebody else will. But you might not, you know, but it also might enliven a discussion from maybe a man who grew up in that kind of environment, and he's never heard another man say something. The other thing I would just say is, you know, we don't have a whole lot of men left here, but I would say, you know, I'm just, and I don't demean myself at all, I'm a woman, but I don't have as much power to speak into a man's life as another man. And so I think that one of the huge movements that has to take place in the church is that men start rising up and saying, we don't treat women that way here. And I think if men, because there's a very interesting movement in the whole bullying movement, that when the bystanders start saying, we don't bully kids here, the bullies lose their power. Right? The bullies lose their power. And so I think that when men start standing up to other men, whether it's corporately from the pulpit or just in a Sunday school class or just as a peer pressure positive, that's what we do here, that we protect women and we honor women here and children, that bully men are going to see a different kind of man that maybe they never saw before, a godly man, a loving man, a man who's full of the fruit of the Spirit, and that might be exceedingly attractive to him and say, how can I be that kind of man? I worked with a couple over the phone that way. I didn't work with him. He had a man in the church who was working with him, but this man was so attracted to this other man because he was just a good, good man, and his dad was such a bad man. It was like, I want to be like you when I grow up. And this man was old, but he's like a child inside, and he's like, I want to be like you. Help me to be more like you. But he didn't care about me. I was just a woman, but to be like a good man, that was his role model. And so I think one of the huge changes that need to take place, in addition to women saying, I'm not putting up with this anymore, which has helped, is for men to say, we don't want you to, and we will stand with you and for you, and we will speak to the men about how to treat women. Yes. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest formative factor is the home they raise in, because boys see how to be men from the men in their life. So I think if the home or the culture, like some cultures are more machismo, you know, maybe Hispanic, I was in, you know, the Middle East, you know, so there's different cultures that sort of support that patriarchal, women have no voice, no power, no right. So that's how they grow up thinking, and so I think that's part of it. I think that the culture that we live in is a very entitled, self-centered culture, and so that breeds more of that. So I think there's that. I think that there's some, you know, sin areas of people's lives that just, even the way we raise children, you know, we're so children-focused in our culture, and we kind of pamper and baby them and don't let them experience the consequences of their poor choices because we don't want to hurt them. So then they end up growing up feeling like everybody should treat them that way, and it's not real life. So I think those are some of the things. There is some evidence, like narcissism. You know, they're not sure exactly what causes narcissism. They're not sure whether it's shaming a lot by the father as a child and a lack of connection with the mother. Donald Dutton's written a book about all that, or whether it's growing up in an abusive home, or whether it's growing up in an affluent home where there's a lot of entitlement, or there's some lack of mirror neurons going on between mother-child that fails to develop the empathy part of the brain. And I'm really concerned about this, just a whole different subject. But you know how it's really important for babies when they're developing to develop those mirror neurons, and how you develop those mirror neurons, which creates the empathy, is that a mother's looking at the baby and the baby goes, and the mother goes, you know, and we mirror their face, and then they mirror our face. Like, that's how they smile. We're smiling and they smile back, and you know, it's that mirroring that's going on. And so that's how a baby develops those social skills and those mirror neurons, which help us tune in to other people. Like, you cry, I cry, you smile, I smile, you frown, I frown. And so they say with some narcissist sociopathic people, some of that's missing. But what I'm concerned about is babies now, what they're finding when moms now, so if you are a nurse or you deal with moms and small children, because of the cell phone technology thing, instead of when we used to feed our baby, we would look at them. Now we feed our baby and we're playing on our cell phone or texting or whatever. So the babies are not getting that connection, and they're growing up with a lot of anxiety and inability to handle social situations because the mirror neurons are not developing properly. So that's, I just am kind of nervous about the next generation of what's coming up. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a woman can stay well with a narcissist depending on the level of narcissism that he has and depending on the level of, this is probably the wrong word, but dependency he has on her. So if she is disposable, like many of the narcissists, and he's not dependent on her at all, she's more dependent on him, she can't stay well. because as soon as she starts putting boundaries down and consequences, which she would need to do in order to stay well, then he will dispose of her. So she better get ready for that, right? But if he's more of the dependent narcissist who feels abandonment issues, if she's going to leave, she's got a lot of leverage, actually. And so she can, like the woman who would pack her bags and go to the hotel for the night, he was like that. And so she would be able to say, she would reassure him and say, I love you and I don't want to have to forgive you because it takes me a long time to forgive you. So I'm just going to prevent this episode. And I'm going and I'll be back tomorrow, but I'm not going to go through this night like this. We've been there a million times. So she got strong enough to set boundaries and consequences, and he got lonely enough because of his narcissism to miss her company and not want her to leave at night. So he learned that he had to control that feeling so that she was able to stay well. Now whenever he gets that way, still, she leaves. So she has her safety plan, her boundaries, her consequences, but she doesn't put herself in a situation where she's the victim of his verbal vomit anymore. Is he still selfish? Yes. Is he still thoughtless? Sometimes yes. But she has gotten strong enough to build her own life, build her own support system, build her own social connections. She doesn't depend on him for much other than a little bit of companionship and financial support. He depends far more on her for things, but she can stay well because she's not expecting anything more from him other than you're not going to vomit on me, and if you do, I'm out of here, right? So she's able to set those limits, but not every woman can do that, and not every man is in that position of being able to want his wife to stay enough that he's adjusting his behavior somewhat. Again, never becoming a loving, gracious, wonderful, empathetic husband, but not a dangerous, ugly one.
And you might not know that until she does.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Any other? Okay. Well, thank you very much. And maybe we'll see you tonight and tomorrow. All right. Bye-bye.